Hi, everybody. I'm Lisa Tversky, and here with me now is Rabbi Dr. David Fox. Rabbi Dr. David Fox is a forensic and clinical psychologist and director of crisis, trauma, and bereavement for High Lifeline. He has lectured as a professor in graduate and medical schools since 1980. He has done research on trauma, law, ethics, and culture and diagnosis. And he serves as both a dayan and the rav of a kehilla. So he is uniquely qualified to help us today on a very difficult subject. And I'm not sure how we got lucky enough to have you give us this time, because it sounds like you're very, very busy. But I really appreciate it, because we are talking today about understanding the specter of death and dying, grief and terminal prognosis, and all of the ways that someone as a Rebbetzin or college teacher might encounter this subject matter of helping someone face death and dying and the grief that comes along with that. It's really an honor and a privilege, and we're so lucky to have somebody with that kind of rounded experience in general, and specifically in this area, really here to help us try and do an even better job when it comes up. Part one, we're going to be talking about loss and grieving, and we're then going to be talking about the specter of death or dying, when the person receives and their family members around them receive a terminal diagnosis, which is also going to incorporate some talk about loss and grieving, but from a very different perspective. And these are going to be two parts of what Rabbi Dr. David Fox has so graciously agreed to help us understand and know how to intervene, and really what our role is when faced with either of those situations. But first, we're going to talk about grief. And I guess I usually start these webinars sort of wanting to define the issue we're talking about. But I'm imagining that, you know, on the one hand, people know what grief is, but on the other hand, there might be some nuances or stages or a process that we aren't necessarily completely educated about, that it would be good for us to have a starting point, a foundation laid by you in understanding what is this thing we call grief. What are we talking about? What does it look like? And what should we know about it that we might not quite yet understand?
Okay. I think we'll start with concepts and terminology.
Okay. Great.
We at times use interchangeably words like mourning and bereavement and grieving, but let's try to define them. So the term bereavement refers to the reality of loss. And this is a part of living, that human beings encounter loss of loved ones, encounter loss of important others, people in their lives. And that sort of fact of life called death is often referred to as bereavement. We say a person is bereft, which means they now have lost someone. Mm-hmm. Now, when we speak about mourning, mourning is the ritual and behavioral processes with which people respond to loss, to death. And our Jewish tradition is very replete, rich with mourning practices. They're part of our halacha. They're part of the schedule of activities or refraining from activities that we do in dealing with loss of someone else. That's the mourning practices that we go through. There's a whole significant section in Shulchan Aruch, which is the laws of Avelus. Bereavement, again, is the loss. Mourning is the steps, the behavioral and ritual steps that we take in the aftermath of losing someone. But grief or grieving is that personal subjective experience that takes place in the course of mourning. And this is often the area, the grieving experience, that receives the least attention and is the least well understood when we encounter a person who may be in a velus, may be going through the mourning processes, but at a deeper internal level is experiencing grief. And this, I think, is an area that, with the right questions during this interview, we might shed some important light on.
So I guess my first question is, what does grief look like? People may have heard of the stages of grief, or maybe not, but, and there might be different variables from person to person, but I think that might be a really great next part of what does grief look like? How do people experience it, and how do we, and maybe then how do we recognize it? But starting with, what does it look like? What's going on?
Good. So again, let's start with contrasting concepts. So mourning practices often differ with culture, and nonetheless, within a specific culture, the mourning practices are fairly objective. They're things that a person does when they are demonstrating their mourning that may refer to things like Shiva, refraining from buying new clothing, not listening to music, saying Kaddish, and so on. And those are mourning processes. And they're fairly uniform within a particular religious system or culture. But the grieving is generally much more subjective, which means that we all grieve differently. That may have to do with the nature of the relationship we had with the person for whom we're now bereft and mourning. That may have to do with our wellness level or our lack of mental health. That may have to do with whether we tend to be intense in our emotional activity, or whether we're more nonchalant or emotionally numb. So the grieving experience does seem to be quite influenced by one's character, one's self. And nonetheless, because over the last 40 years or so, there's been a lot more observational research, and there's been a lot more clinical study of that grieving experience, we have begun to identify different features of grief. And I think this is important for everyone, the Rebbetzins, the Kala teachers, the rabbis, to have some grasp of grieving as we understand it. Now, the popular wisdom for quite a long time was that there are hierarchical stages that people go through, sort of a linear scaffolding or stages of grief. And in contemporary views, we don't believe this is so, which means that we do think that there are different forms of grief experience. Not everyone goes through all of them, and not everyone goes through them in the same sequence.
Got it.
But we can definitely identify different aspects of the grieving experience which take place inside of a person.
Which makes so much more sense than this notion that everyone is going to grieve in the exact same order as if they're making a cake or a souffle. Like it has to, it makes so much more sense that we just understand that there's concepts of what is common when someone is grieving. So tell us about the different hallmarks of grieving.
Okay, so those hallmark experiences, what I would draw our attention to is that they're not unlike the experiences we have when we love a person while they're alive, which means that if we are self-aware and we monitor the different shifting experiences we have when we're in a close relationship with someone we love and care about, we will go through most of those experiences as we are trying to cope with their demise. When they're not in our lives anymore, some of those same flavors are going to come into consciousness. For example, we love someone very deeply. We can't stand to be without them. We miss them. And when we're grieving someone, we miss them. And sometimes that missing them has a denial type of quality to it, that we can't face it. We don't want to accept it. We don't want to acknowledge it. We keep looking for them. We're feeling their presence. And sometimes that's referred to as a denial, that we haven't really come to terms. And it's hard to come to terms with death, because what does it mean? They were here yesterday, they're not here anymore, and they're not coming back. And that's hard for the rational brain. The rational brain, not even getting into the emotions, the rational brain to completely understand that what happened to the spirit and what happened to the personality, what happened to that energy, the heart stopped and it all evaporates. So that would be an example of, we know how difficult it is to be without someone we love, and it's very difficult to accept when they're gone, and that they're gone forever. Now, we also know that anger comes out at times for some people as they are wrestling with grief. That may take the form of anger at the doctors for not saving their life, or anger at the driver of the car, which is an understandable anger. It can be anger at the person for abandoning me and leaving me and dying on me. So the experience of anger, and it's not only the struggle to come to terms with it, but to admit that as much as I'm feeling bereft and have lost this person, I still have some anger towards them. And it can be anger about where they've left me. It can also be unfinished anger that we never worked out things in the relationship.
Right.
And we'll never be able to. And they never asked me for an apology, and they never did this. And that can be an experience which people go through and can stay stuck in the grief process. You know, sometimes we torture ourselves with our inability to bring them back, or if only we would have done this, or I knew we shouldn't have gone to that hospital, or I told him not to cross the street, and we'll start bargaining that if only this and if only that. And again, from a distance, it seems like a useless, obsessional preoccupation with things that no longer matter. But yet that's a stage some people go through, an experience some people go through in trying to accept the reality of death, because we don't want to accept it. And we're trying to find some type of almost retroactive intervention we could have done to prevent it.
Right.
It's also very common for people struggling with grief to go into something similar to depression. And it may not be what we'd call clinical depression, and it may not be dysthymia, and it's generally not major psychotic depression, but people numb out, and people can't stop crying, or people no longer can cry, and they're without energy and without drive and motivation, and they're sleeping too much, or nothing holds their interest, nothing makes them happy. And sometimes the Rebbetzin or the rabbi or the good friend wants to cheer them up and snap them out of it, but that is one of those grieving experiences that they probably need to go through when they're going through it. And there are things we can say, things we shouldn't say, but it is an experience quite common to the grieving individual. It's similar to depression, although it's not the same dynamics as a depressive illness. And then most people in the course of going through grieving grapple with acceptance. And sometimes that's a stage of transcendence they reach. Sometimes that's feeling that they have resolved the unfinished aspects of the relationship. They've forgiven the person, or they've begged forgiveness from that person's soul. And sometimes people will get to that experience of feeling that I can move on. But again, the more intense the relationship, the more meaningful my relationship was with that person, the more we may find that acceptance is a place I get to some of the time. And other times I'm back in the grieving again. So that would be a synopsis of the different elements of the grief experience. But again, they're not linear, they're not hierarchical, and some of them people get through in a shorter time. Sometimes people stay with one of those experiences for a much longer time.
Right. And just like you had said that, you know, our experience of it will be affected by our general kind of personality structure or personality traits. Is that also true in terms of, you know, the stage someone will have the hardest, not stage, but the element that someone will have the hardest time with is the element that they're sort of struggle with in general? You know, the person who is angry but can't handle that they're angry, or, you know, is that, does that also kind of line up? Or you find that people have, you know, the hardest time when they're angry? Is there a commonality, or it's more individual? People are going to have the hardest time with? Some people have the hardest time with feeling depressed, and some people will have the hardest time with being angry, especially if they're angry at their spouse or God. What do people struggle with the most?
Okay, so that's a very perceptive question. And yes, to a significant degree, if a person tends to get stuck on certain feelings or certain psychological dynamics, so it is quite likely that in their experience of grief, that they're going to be themselves. The stuff they wrestle with, that's going to be what they're wrestling with in their reaction to loss. However, I think there's an important exception, and that is that if someone's never gone through loss before, and for them the loss is more traumatic, they've never had to deal with this before, then it may follow more of a trauma trajectory, which means they'll recognize, or those who know them well will recognize, that they're really not themselves. I've never seen him like this. She's never been that way before. She always was so bubbly and upbeat and optimistic. That's gone. Meaning the way this person in traumatic loss will be grieving, may in fact unleash or tap into parts of themselves that most often they're not displaying, they're not going to manifest. Mm-hmm. You have the person who was always good at coping and he was always there to encourage other people, and now he's lifeless. He is in such a state of detachment. You can't cheer him up. He has nothing kind to say to others. So when you see a person going through a more complicated grief where they're out of character, that will be more likely a sign that they're going through something traumatic, such as their first loss or the loss of someone who held a special place for them.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a very unexpected, sudden type of loss would also fall into, you know, a sudden accident, God forbid, whatever. Something like that you would also look at as a traumatic loss.
A traumatic loss is one that we had no time to prepare for, and or the way in which it occurred was unlike anything we would have anticipated.
Right. And is there a general, or is it more specific to whatever the person is experiencing at a time, sort of structure or format for what you would say to the self of the Rebbetzin or the Kala teacher or the Rav in relation to that person? Is there a general thing? Is there a general piece of educational advice you have? Or if they're angry, this, but if they're more depressed, that? What would be the guidance in terms of what is your presence supposed to be like for that person?
Good. So I'd like to offer some valuable recommendations in helping others face someone who's going through loss and someone who's going through grief. Okay. The first is make no assumptions, which means don't assume you know exactly what they're going through. Don't assume that they are supposed to be handling their grief in a different way than they are. And don't try to over-identify with their experience in the belief that that will console them. Okay, so no assumptions, no judgment. And that leads to the second valuable recommendation: listen to them, don't talk to them. Don't tell them your story, don't distract them. Don't try to cheer them out or try to talk them out of what they're thinking or feeling. And listen, really, in halacha, in the halachas of Avelus, this is what Shulchan Aruch says: let them do the talking. You're not there to preach, you're not there to teach, you're not there to do therapy. You're there to prompt them or give them an atmosphere where they can start talking about who they lost and how it's hitting them now. So validate virtually anything they tell you that they're thinking or feeling. Just say, sure, you've gone through a very, very significant loss and you're now feeling, again, whatever it is they said they're feeling. They said they're feeling sad. Of course, you're feeling sad. Or they say, you know, I'm so anxious, I can't get a grip on myself, I don't know what to do. Sure, you've gone through loss of someone you cared about, and right now you don't know how you're going to proceed. So validate, reflect back what they're telling you their experience is, but never judge it, never try to alter or correct it, and never give them advice. And really the role of the Rebbetzin in particular is to listen and to be validating and to be supportive. And virtually any experience that this person shares with you is likely to be a normal experience. It's not something that they should be told they need to get over. Right. You know, we've seen such horrible situations. I know we've all had the horror stories, but you go into the Shiva house and let's say it's a woman and she's just lost her husband, and a well-meaning friend will say, look, you're allowed to get married after Shloshim, and I have a great guy for you. Okay, now again, you would never say that. I would hope to never say that. And it's well-intended because it means I have a hard time watching you suffer.
Right.
And I want you to get over it because it's hard for me. But remember that when we are approaching the grieving individual, it's not about whether or not I'm comfortable sitting there with them. Mm-hmm. It's not about trying to make myself feel better by saying something wise or witty or telling them a great story that I read. It's listening, it's validating, it's being supportive, not criticizing, not judging, and not making an assumption that they shouldn't be feeling what they feel or they shouldn't be dealing with the grief they are.
Right. I think it's such an important, you know, it's a generally important piece in terms of, you know, pastoral counseling, that learning how to, you know, kind of sit with where the person is, and not jumping in with the answer or the solution or the idea or the, and I think that because Rabbanim and even Rebbetzins are often called on specifically for advice and, you know, very goal-oriented, what should I do and can I and am I not allowed to, kind of switching gears and saying this is just about sitting. And even if the person, because sometimes it's the person themselves kind of pulling for, so what could you tell me? You know, almost what could you tell me to fix me? What could you tell me to snap me out of it? And just sort of resisting our own impulse or their impulse and saying, you know, this is, of course, this is where you're at. And especially if it's in Shiva, this is how you're going to feel now. That's normal. You need to allow it. It's okay to allow your process to happen and for us to be okay with it and for us to make sure that they know it's okay to sit and have their process. And that's going to take probably beyond Shiva also.
Yes. Let me say two things about Shiva. Shiva is a rotten experience. It's a rotten experience to go through. I went through Shiva about a year and a half ago for the first time. Mm. But even before my encounter with the loss of a father, from the work that I do in High Lifeline, looking at the Shiva experience, the difficulty, the challenge is that well-meaning people try to distract you from the work of grief. And Avelis is not to entertain people. It's not to get into conversations with people. It's to set the atmosphere so this person who's in Avelis, which means the behavior of mourning, can also go through the psychology of grieving, which is an internal process. And what we want to impart to the person who's supposed to be grieving and probably is trying to grieve, we want to impart to them the idea to listen to their own experience, to tune in to what they're going through. Mm. And to acknowledge it, self, this is where I'm at. This is where my mind is. This is what I'm noticing about myself. Now, if the person who's in grief is with a trusted other, like a rabbi, a rebbetzin, someone who can listen to them and accept them, so they may opt to share, to divulge where they're at right now. Mm. Obviously, if it's a person who I don't know well, I may be more frugal about what I share with them. But the message a concerned other wants to offer this grieving person is to be attentive to what you're going through. And then the second part is that you're right, that Shiva is an ordeal. but what takes place post Shiva and during that shloshim and beyond the shloshim, this is another ordeal because people drift away. There's no one coming in and giving me my meals and comforting me and consoling me. And that often is where the deep, profound impact of the loss hits, because this person does have to sit with herself or with himself. And this is where we see some of those other grieving experiences emerge, when no one's there to distract me or keep me busy, and I'm recognizing that I'm in a depressed state.
Right.
Or I recognize I'm in an angry mode right now. And this is where the Rebbetzin, the close friend, can do so much good by checking in with that person once the door to Shiva has been closed and they're trying to get on with their lives, to recognize that they're still going to be going through the struggle of grieving, and, right. and to offer to be there for them.
And are there sort of common philosophical hashkafic struggles that someone will bring to their Rav or their Rebbetzin that you think that, you know, they should be prepared to answer, that it's appropriate to answer, as opposed to the process of helping the person sit with their grief and allow that process to happen without jumping in? Are there in that role when they're being asked or queried, not when they're trying to offer it unsolicited, but when they're being asked or queried, you know, how could Hashem do this? Or what's the appropriate role at that point? Okay. How should they be prepared for that?
All right. So probably the most common question that gets brought to the clergy person, to the rabbi, to the Rebbetzin, is the why question. Why did this have to happen? Why did it happen to them? Why did it happen in that way? Why was there so much pain? Why did they suffer? And the why question, that's that theological question that torments people. And so much of the time, the well-meaning Rebbetzin or rabbi attempts to answer it, or attempts to answer it too quickly, and there's no satisfying answer. And often the better response is, this is a profound question, and you may sit with that question and one day you'll find a perspective, or there may come a time that you want to look at the process of questioning and trying to make sense of things which may or may not seem fair. Mm-hmm. But we generally acknowledge, we validate that this is a question of grieving. Why did it happen? But it's not one that has a rapid answer. It may never have a satisfying answer. And because the why question pertains to suffering, that why there is so much suffering, I generally try to guide a person very gently in understanding that the answer that might make sense to me or that might work for me probably is not going to click for you. Mm. And it's such a personal voyage. It's a journey through your own mind and your own spirit, seeing how long does the why question haunt you? And do you ever get to a point where you have a perspective? And many people don't. Mm-hmm. And I think it's reckless to try offering my take on why you're going through what you went through, or my theory about why this person had to suffer. It's just foreign to Jewish thought that any of us have the ability to know why someone else had their suffering.
Right.
So it's almost like caution.
It's almost like saying, I know what's in God's mind, which we obviously can't know. and
it's presumptuous.
Right. And that, but we jump into it because we so don't want to see this person in pain. And we think if we can give them something that speaks to them, they'll stop being in pain. But really, you're saying resist the urge. Don't experience it as, oh, I'm not a good clergy person if I don't give them a hashkafic perspective. Understand that this is part of their grieving process. And just like you shouldn't, you know, talk to them about dating after Shloshim, you don't rush in with other answers, solutions. You figure out the language you want to use to not answer so you can allow their grieving process to happen for them.
Yes, and let me add some things to that also. Religious Jewish people, in trying to understand and in trying to cope, sometimes will ask questions like, where is the neshama right now? Or is this person in Gan Eden? Or if I forget to say Kaddish, what are the ramifications? Will they go to Gehenna? And we'll ask these very celestial questions. Now, it's possible that a person who's a makubal, a person who's very, very learned and understands that other dimension, might have certain yedios, might have certain knowledge. Generally, it trivializes the process if we try to respond by telling them things that we can't possibly know and we can't verify. And to instead to encourage the person that so much of the time, the mystery of death leads one to wonder about the spirit and to wonder about the Olam HaNeshamos. And while he comes studying these things or developing a relationship with someone who does understand this body of information, where it could be very fruitful. But to go and say, well, right now it's day 11 and the neshama is here and this is what's happening and the malachim are doing this. Unless they know what I'm talking about, unless I'm dealing with a congregant who really, it can be very confusing. And I think that's something that we don't want to invalidate by saying, look, you shouldn't be getting into these things. We validate that they have a curiosity. They wish they understood, but not to try to make it a book you can read or a course you can take, but rather that this may be something that you're going to wonder about and want to study. But hearing metaphysical explanations for things, it may not do that much when the person is feeling deeply sad, mm-hmm. or the person's feeling deeply confused. And so much of the grief process, it has to play its way out.
Right.
We can't remove it by giving them data.
Right. And almost sometimes people create a secondary issue because you jump in and you give what should be a satisfying answer and the person doesn't feel satisfied and then they start wondering what's wrong with them. As mm-hmm. opposed to if you wouldn't jump in, you would say, of course you're feeling confused and, you know, whatever else they might be presenting, and that's normal. And then they just feel normal. They still have those hard, difficult feelings, but they feel normal. Not, I asked a question, I got an answer, so now I still don't feel good, but I also don't feel normal because I should feel fine. I got an answer to my question. It winds up kind of compounding things. Not that that's anyone's intention, but it often winds up compounding things because we haven't just let them have the process they need to have. This is grieving.
True. And we must recognize that in our multifaceted brain, in broad terms, we've got our logical half and we've got the other half. And when it's that other half that's activated because of trauma or because of grieving, because of sadness, because of loss, and then we shunt the experience purely into the cerebral part by having an answer for every question they ask us. So we have done them a disservice because we've in essence discouraged them from being there with their emotional experience mm-hmm. or their spiritual struggle by trying to reduce it into a piece of information. Right. You know, another thing I think we need to recognize as religious Jews is that whereas as I said at the beginning, there often is a sameness within a given religion to the availus practices, meaning that Orthodox Jews do availus, the behavior, the ritual in a certain way. What we're seeing is that, let's say, different subsets or different sects within the Orthodox world sometimes do grieving a little bit different. Mm. My associate, Zahava Farbman, she's the associate director in our department at High Lifeline. She's doing some really groundbreaking doctoral research right now. And one of the things she's been looking at is really trying to compare, let's say, I'll just use examples, Satmar versus Chabad versus yeshivish approaches to the grieving process. Mm. And in a subset, let's say, for whom Hasidus is a very spiritual process, the areas of grieving focus may be different, say, than in a group for whom Judaism is experienced as a very intellectual process. So even looking at what people struggle with in the Torah world in general does seem to have some variability based on subcultural lifestyle and what's important and what's emphasized. And the Rebbetzin or the teacher in the school or the Menahelis or whomever it is really might do a little bit of probing into how does this family deal with Avelis and how does this family, given their Rosh Hashiva's guidance or their Rebbe's influence, how are they dealing with the grief? And how can I approach them in a way that's empathic, meaning that's sensitive to their experience without me trying to get them into my experience or to do it my way?
Right, right.
You know, I had an encounter recently in my practice, someone from a particular Hasidic group lost a spouse and has remarried. And now the children are due to go to the kever of the deceased parent. And in this particular Hasidic, now that the other parent, the surviving parent, has married, so they're not supposed to go to the kever. Right. Now the question is, are we going to send these young kids alone without the parent? And what's going to happen? And how are they going to deal with that? And what I've discovered is that in some of the, let's call them sects or subcultures, there's a very, what I would call a compassionate dispensation, that under these circumstances, the remarried surviving spouse can accompany the children. And yet I found in other groups that under no circumstances can the surviving remarried spouse accompany the children there. Now, the way those children are going to grieve in group A is not going to be identical with that of children in group B because of environmental or psychosocial differences. Wow. And so everyone who's going to be doing the nichum or going to be doing the comforting or the consoling, we probably want to check into their system to find out what's done and what's not done.
Right, right. Wow. It's a lot to think about. But again, if we remind everybody to remain open and not judgmental and not put their own experiences in and listen, you will make less faux pas in the attempt at being comforting in general, just great advice in the first place that that line for us of not judgmental, open, not fixer mode, not anecdote telling, put myself in when I was in your situation mode. That's just, you know, invaluable recommendations. Now, I feel like we have a great sense of what this is we're talking about and how we can be helpful in general. And I think that we would agree that everyone who goes through the grieving process goes through it differently, and everything's normal pretty much, and everyone doesn't need to go to therapy because there was a loss. But at what point, you know, here's Shiva's over and maybe Shloshim's over and the Rebbetzin or the Kala teacher continues to reach out to be, you know, available to help in the grieving process. At what point or what cues or what things should maybe clue a Rebbetzin or Kala teacher or Rav in that this person does need something beyond the chizuk and the shoulder, that they're struggling and their resources or lack of resources really indicate, or something's going on that indicates that they're not just going to go through the grieving process and move on, that something's been thwarted. The grieving process has thwarted, or their process has been thwarted, and they're not moving on with life. What should start to worry or concern or make a Kala teacher or Rebbetzin question whether their chizuk is enough?
Good. So let's agree with your first premise. It's a valid premise that not everybody who goes through grieving is going to go through complicated grieving. And not everybody who's grieving is going to fall into a depression. And not everybody who shows indications of a depressed mood is necessarily suffering from a mood disorder when they're grieving. However, they're usually in the process of working through grief is change, which means we find that the energy level shifts, that behaviors change. When a person really seems locked into a rut, which means they're not getting past the somberness, they're showing signs of being very fixated and obsessed with feelings of guilt, self-condemnation. When the depression doesn't lift, they're either not able to stop the crying, or they don't cry, they're emotionally detached and numb, and they've really slowed down. They're not reacting emotionally to things. They're not eating, they're not sleeping, or conversely, all they're doing is sleeping. So when we see that there are extreme changes in their level of functioning or non-functioning, so this is where we want to consider having a discussion with them, that you may be going through this at a more intense level, and to look for a qualified clinician. Now let's remember that not every good, competent clinician has background in grieving and depression.
Right.
So you really want to direct them to someone who's worked with crisis or with trauma, or who understands the complications of bereavement. Just sending them for CBT or DBT or EMDR may or may not be the first move.
Right. And
we don't want to forfeit that Rebbetzin's existing or pre-existing rapport with the person. We don't want this person who's having difficulty with grief to think that, you know, my Rebbetzin dumped me, she abandoned me, I'm too much for her. We want to maintain that psychosocial support with them. But it's the extremes of behavior that we look out for. Generally, it's okay to tell the person in grief who expresses discontent with how they're coping. It's useful to say to them that right now this is how you're dealing with the grief, and you'll probably notice in the next days next week, that things do begin to shift for you. We do plant that idea because most of the time it's accurate that things do begin to shift. But when things don't shift and people are really stuck and we hear the cynicism or they begin saying scary things like, I really think I no longer have any meaning in my own existence and I'd be better off if I was dead too. If it's when they're saying the startling things, or let's take maybe a somewhat less common situation where the unfinished business they have with the deceased person is really pathological, meaning it was an abusive person or a person who traumatized them or whom they traumatized, and then there's a whole other strata of the grief that either involves rage or involves guilt. When the Rebbetzin begins to sense that there is really deeper trauma going on here, that might also be our cue to make the recommendation that things are going on that might be addressed in confidence with a person who's skilled to look at these things.
Right.
We certainly do have those, thank God, less common situations, but when there's really unfinished stuff and that's what's causing this person to unravel.
Right. You mentioned a minute ago they shouldn't feel dumped, you know, A, because, you know, the Rebbetzin could theoretically continue to play a role in their life, but also just because you don't want them to feel dumped. You know, sometimes it's a matter of really giving the Rebbetzin the phraseology, the even helping the Rebbetzin or college teacher or Rav understand what is going to be different by this person going to therapy for their grieving process than, you know, hey, of course I'm upset, I just need to keep talking to you. And sometimes it's a matter of the Rebbetzin really see something that's telling them we need to go to the next level, but we need to help them know how to express to the person why they need to go to the next level, and even more so, what will be different for them, so that they themselves don't feel like I'm just dumping her off on somebody else to talk to. No, there's a different process. So what would you want to explain to them to be able to explain to the person about what will be different? What's different about that?
Mm-hmm. And possibly a safe way to present things to a person who's struggling with complicated grief is to say that we are familiar in our world with specialization. And there are things that the internist will treat until they become pulmonological or cardiological. And then we need to go to someone who really works with this particular condition. And to be able to say that I am here to be supportive as you work on the Avalis process. However, the level in which you're experiencing your grieving really needs a specialized focus. And that right now your grief has you in a state of great despair, or your grief has you in a state of feeling very stricken with guilt. And this is something that's very private and very personal, for whom working with someone who specializes in understanding and helping us understand how we can navigate through this. And the greatest gift I can offer you is the gift of being able to see someone who I trust. Who will focus with you.
Right.
And just like no clinician can be an expert at everything, a Rabbi Rebbetzin cannot always be an expert in all aspects of grieving.
Right, right. That's a great muscle for them to have, you know, just to have that language in their back pocket of understanding why I'm moving you from me to whoever. Is there anything on loss, mourning, bereavement, grief that you would recommend as a reading for people who want to educate themselves further about this? Any great books you would recommend or anything else?
There are in the Jewish literature some exceptional resources. I think the Jewish Way in Loss and Mourning, or Death and Mourning by the late Rabbi Maurice Lamb is a standard. There's an excellent compendium on the laws and the practices of mourning. And I'm blocking on the author right now, but it's a black book. For those who have more of a, let's say, a Torah mindset, who want to know more about our traditions, Gesher HaChaim is a classic, and it's been translated, large segments of it have been translated into English. And then, of course, there's the ancient classic Ma'abar Yabok, written by one of the very early Italian Achronim, who does try to look at the bridge between this life and the afterlife.
This has really been a great overview of grief and mourning and loss and bereavement and what all those means and what we need to know and what our role is. And we're looking forward to part two on the specter of death and dying. Thank you so much.
Thank you too,
Rabbi Dr. David Fox, for giving us this time and for in the future giving us time for the next part. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.